Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
The American founders, they would look to Genesis chapter 3 and the story of the fall in trying to understand human nature so they could better construct institutions of governance that would take that into account.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Daniel Dreisbach, professor of justice, law, and criminology at American University. We'll talk with him later on in today's program on the topic of Christianity and the American political tradition. First, we're joined by John Miller. He is director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Scott.
A couple of different pieces I want to talk with you about today. One from Axios a bit ago, talking about the lack of local news sources in many places across the country. Not a surprise for those who have been paying attention. What are some of the factors that are contributing to the decline of local news sources?
There are many fewer local newspapers today than there was a generation ago. That's just a simple fact. You can look up the numbers. Many have just failed. And there are lots of reasons for this. The internet, of course, is the big one, the rise of the internet. And for a lot of these local papers, the loss of classified advertising was devastating to them. This was important to their economies. This was important to their bottom line. And as those classified ads moved online, they lost a ton of revenue. This was, losing a huge amount of your advertising. So that was a problem for them. And I'll just point out, it's too bad. I love local newspapers. I wish we had several in every community in America. I'm an old newspaper guy. I like getting them. I like turning the pages of newspapers and reading them and so forth. But, the reason why the classified ads moved online is because that's where people want them. That's where it's better. We're better served that way. So that's why it happened. And we should be grateful that the internet did this, because now you can find your help wanted ads or your car for sale ads or whatever you would normally put a generation ago in classified advertising. Now, now it's on eBay or some other site. And it's so much easier to do that kind of conduct that kind of commerce versus how it used to be. So that's good for all of us. It's bad for these local newspapers. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate. And that makes me sad. But that was the number one challenge.
Does the absence of local news sources necessarily mean that community engagement or awareness is suffering, or can digital media platforms, social media platforms, just change the way that people are receiving that information?
It's different in different places. I think there are definitely areas that are now, you might say, underserved by journalism, and the loss of a local newspaper in your community, of course, that's going to have a kind of effect on how people understand what's happening in their communities. But, people are always curious about what's going on in their areas, and a lot of that has just moved online onto social media, and that's good effects and bad effects. The good effects are you can learn from your neighbors what's going on. It's social media is a great tool for organizing, for spreading information. It's also, an engine, a fuel tool for conspiracies and rumor mongering is really great at spreading that stuff too. And so that's a kind of challenge as well. But people can stay on top of what's happening at their city council meetings and their school board meetings and so forth. A lot of that stuff is online. You can watch these things streaming. There are a lot of ways to engage and participate that does not involve reading a local newspaper. I wish there was a local newspaper in all these communities and people could read them, but it's maybe not as bad as some of the worst case scenarios we see laid out for us in the analysis of this.
Talking with John Miller, director of the Dial Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. The absence or the decline of local news sources, do you see it as a problem that needs solving, or is it just a natural cycle?
Well, who solves it? That's really the question. I'm like, sure, that's a problem we should solve. We should solve this problem every day of how do we gather news and information about the world and understand our predicament. That's a problem ordinary people have to solve every day, I would think. You know, in terms of what you're asking, though, is there a problem to be solved here? I guess, although, you know who shouldn't solve it is the government. And you see a lot of people turning to the government for a solution. There's a kind of person when, you know, presented with a problem, it's like, what can the government do about that? And we see proposals to prop up local publications, whether in print or digital or something, with public subsidies, which I think is a big mistake. If people want news, they're gonna get it, and they're gonna have to find ways to get it and so forth. We shouldn't have to subsidize these things. And if we do, we're not gonna get an honest accounting. If the journalists are employed by the government, they're not gonna question the government. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're often talking about. We say the importance of journalists is questioning what our public officials are doing, asking hard questions, looking at their performance, their behavior and so forth. That's a really important role for them. That's the thing we want them to do. But if these are their paymasters, then how good will they be at that?
Illinois is doing this in a way. Illinois now is providing $25 million in tax credits over the next 5 years for local news organizations to hire and retain newsroom workers. That's not a direct payment, I suppose, but it's a tax credit. It's a subsidy. And my guess is that those entities would be loath to speak out against removing that tax credit in the future.
Exactly. And that highlights the problem is then you can't get people who are honest about what's going on in their own state, for example, and how the government is behaving. And it'll be more than just this tax credit. It would be, you know, you no longer, you know, they'd be reluctant to question incumbents, for example, who have the power of their purse strings and so on. So in our laboratories of democracy in the states, I say, you know, good luck to you, Illinois. I suspect this is a bad idea. We can do an analysis in 5 or 10 years and see how this works out. I think probably not well, but there you go.
Do larger media companies, and we see consolidation and larger media entities buying up some of the smaller newspapers or media outlets across the country, do those larger media companies have what we would say is an ethical responsibility to support or do more for local journalism?
Not really. I mean, an economic responsibility, perhaps. You know, the thing I like to ask the students here at Hillsdale College in our intro to journalism courses, I'll say, what's the purpose of a newspaper? And
which, by the way, is the same purpose of a radio station, which is a question I ask in my classes.
Right. And you know, you get these really good answers, and they're earnest about, you know, informing the citizenry of what's happening and this sort of thing. Like, that's all true. But there's actually a prior answer to that. And the purpose of a newspaper is to make money. This is a business. It's a small business in a lot of places. And the publishers who own these newspapers, you know, they're not wealthy people. They often work hard and struggle. But this is a business, and you got to make it as a business. And so that applies to bigger companies that are buying smaller papers and so forth. They've got to find a way to make money out of the community, to provide a service that people are willing to pay for, willing to turn over your quarter or 50 cents or dollar or whatever it costs every day to get your local newspaper. You got to provide something that people think, you know, that's worth it. I would like that. And so forth. That's fundamentally their responsibility. So should they be ethical? Yes, they should be ethical, but fundamentally, they should be economic. They should provide a service that people want. That's how our market system works.
Do you think that the decline in local news coverage, local news sources, has influenced the societal trust in media overall? A chicken and egg question. Did people distrust news media leading to less of it, or does less coverage more lead to more distrust?
Yeah, I don't know. That is a chicken egg. It's sort of a possible question to answer. I suppose maybe. There's been an awful lot of analysis on this and some reports and so forth, and I don't know the answer to that. You know, trust in media is down significantly in the last 5 or 10 years. Trust in a lot of institutions is down. It's, you know, Congress has never been high, but it's also like never, I don't know if it's never been lower, but it's quite low now. But if you look across the board, there is a kind of crisis in trust of our public institutions. And that includes the schools, the universities, all kinds of things. And the media is a part of that.
John J. Miller, director of the Hillsdale Dow Journalism Program, will continue our conversation talking about news deserts next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
Are you looking to take your business to the next level? Don't let staffing issues or HR red tape stop you from growing. The most successful businesses are those that have mastered their HR and staffing needs, and they have done it with O2 Employment Services. Finding qualified help is harder and more expensive than ever. HR regulations are getting more and more complex and confusing. For over 20 years, O2 has been providing the foundation successful businesses need to grow, assisting employers with their HR, payroll, workers' comp, benefits, and staffing. Partnering with O2 gives you the expertise you need to manage your business and employees. Outsourcing your HR and staffing is no longer a luxury. It's a necessity for successful businesses, and it is more affordable than you think. Let O2 show you how we can help you reduce your HR complexities, hire the right talent, and get back to growing your business. Call O2 today at 530-223-4674 or visit us online at O2ES.com.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at School of Hard Knocks. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us. We believe there's a difference between a man and a woman, and I think you probably know what it is.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1460 AM.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You can find older episodes of this program, plus all the great Hillsdale College audio available, our online courses podcast, our K-12 classical education podcast, Hillsdale Dialogues, and new Liberty and Learning with Mark Levin and Larry Arne, all at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. We've been talking with John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program, about a decline in local news sources across the country. There was a separate report recently from the Local News Initiative at Northwestern University. They did a report right at the end of 2024 about news deserts across the country. I want to ask about the phrase, first of all. People have perhaps heard about food deserts that exist across the country, and there's actually a lot of debate about whether or not that's an actual thing. Do they exist? Is it a problem? This phrase, news deserts, do you buy into what they are describing here?
No, absolutely not. I object to the metaphor. Now, it's a good report. It's an interesting report. It's worth looking at great data on what's happening to local newspapers around the country. And it points out that there are a lot of places, a lot of counties where they don't have even a single news source about what's happening on your county commission and so forth. There are a lot of people in these places that, you know, they don't have a news source, and many have only one. And sometimes that's just a digital thing. So the report has a lot of great information and data, and it's worth looking at. What they have done, though, is they've created this metaphor of a news desert, and I just find that inappropriate, because people who live in these so-called news deserts have amazing tools to gather news and information in their phones, on their laptops, with their internet connections and so forth. And I would much rather live in a quote unquote news desert today than live in a world before the internet. Mm-hmm. If what I'm trying to do is gather news and information, if I want to know what's happening in my state, in my country, in my world, we have incredible power to learn that stuff right now. And for as bad as journalism can be, and very often it's full of ignorance and even lies, as bad as journalism can be nowadays, there is great journalism if you know where to look, if you want to go find it. It is out there to be had, and it's never been easier to get before. So even if you live in a quote unquote news desert, you can be reading about the war in Ukraine. You get daily updates with maps and so forth. You can read about what's happening in Argentina with the new president there. You can read about what's happening in Washington D.C. and so forth. You get this information. You know, arguably you're getting less information than you might have a generation ago about, you know, what's happening at a city council meeting, at least through the traditional means. And so this idea of a news desert, what you're trying to capture is, you know, the absence of a print publication in right. the community. But this idea that you're thirsting for something you can't have. So the aridity of a desert, my goodness, these are, in a sense, oases, you know, yeah. Every time you pick up your phone and you want to know what's going on.
The authors of the report about these news deserts sort of summarize that Donald Trump won the areas that exist in these so-called news deserts. And they mean this as a call to arms, to increase coverage. You've got to be better informed. But is it possible that the more you read mainstream news sources, perhaps the less informed you actually are about the country?
Yeah, that's very possible. That you know, it depends where you go, of course. And the authors of this report pointed out that Trump won by a lot of these areas that are so-called news deserts. And they're very careful to say that, you know, they're not saying that Trump voters are low-information voters who don't know what's going on. They were very careful to say that's not what we're saying here, because they recognize a lot of these areas are rural. And Trump did very well in rural areas for reasons of economy and culture and so forth. You know, farmers tend to support Trump. You know, people in small towns tend to support Trump in the 2024 election. So they say this is a correlation rather than a kind of causation. So I thought the authors of the report were very careful not to do this sort of stupid hot take about Trump voters are dumb and they don't know what's going on. That's why they voted for this guy. They actually didn't say that. They actually pushed against that idea. And so that was good. I don't know what the lesson is here, apart from the fact that, people are consuming news in different ways right now. And that presents a challenge for all of us in the media. And, you know, if we're in the media, and remember, these are for profit businesses, you got to provide things that people want and they're willing to pay for, and, got to find a new way to do that.
We find on campus a number of journalism guests throughout the term from various parts of the country, various jobs. Students generally always have a similar question for them, I notice, and it is, in essence, where do you get your news? How do you get the news? And years ago, it would be easy. I read the local paper. I listen to the local radio station, right? And you can perhaps knock things out in that way. There weren't as many choices. There weren't as many options. So I'll ask you, how do you personally stay informed about national, but local news as well? Have you noticed a change in availability, quality of what you're able to access?
The big change, of course, is social media and its, you know, quote unquote algorithms and what they deliver. And the mistake a lot of people make with their gathering of news information, I see this with students all the time, is they just allow themselves to become slaves to the algorithm. Mm-hmm. In other words, they take what the social media platforms are feeding them, and they are not critical or deliberate in their consumption of news. They take what's coming at them. When asked a question like, what do you read? How do you learn about what's happening in the world? They'll be like, oh, I read Twitter. And, you know, you can turn your Twitter feed into a pretty good news feed if you personalize it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also be really lazy about it and just kind of take what the algorithm is and the people behind it are choosing to give to you. So my advice for everybody, students mainly, because they're the ones who ask me all the time, but really for everybody is be deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
You can use Twitter and social media well to gather news and information. But, you know, one of the things I do is I wake up every morning and I am going to news sites that I trust and reading things there. And I also go to news sites I don't always trust. I mean, I read a lot of news, but one of the things I do is I go to those sites, and every morning I'm actually kind of running through a list of, you know, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. I get my sports information from The Athletic and also the Detroit News, because these are the teams I care about. So be deliberate. Go out and find this stuff. You can sign up for email lists where trusted publications send you things, so it winds up in your inbox. But construct a kind of system that works for you. And then you can mess around with the algorithm a little bit and see what comes at you, see what's unexpected and so forth. But be deliberate.
John Miller is director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College, also national correspondent for National Review as well. You can find him writing there and elsewhere. John, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Daniel Dreisbach from American University will talk with us about Christianity and the American political tradition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Ready to turn your dreams into reality? At Simpson University, we offer a private Christian education that enriches your academic journey with faith and purpose. Whether you're pursuing your undergraduate degree, completing your degree, or advancing through graduate studies, our dynamic programs, personalized mentorship, and vibrant community are here to support you. Discover how Simpson University can help you achieve your goals and grow spiritually. Visit simpsonu.edu today to learn more. Simpson University, where your potential is limitless.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Have you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential? Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it! Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
The Shasta College Community Education Catalog for spring-summer is out. You may have received a hard copy in your mailbox, or you can view all the courses online. If you're looking for some fun adventures, maybe you want to get in shape, or maybe you're looking to start a side hustle or a new business, the community education courses have something for everyone. Check it out today at shastacollege.edu.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
The property insurance crisis in California is starting to affect the business insurance property also. 200 to 300% rate increases in business property rates or not writing business insurance at all are becoming the norm. At Siskiyou Insurance, we have over 100 years experience in writing business insurance in the North State. We can help. We live here and care about our community and want to make sure that you keep your business with a local agent that knows our town and supports it every day. And we'll get you the best deal we can. Call Curtis Byron at Siskiyou Insurance Services, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345. Siskiyou Insurance, 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to find the show on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We're joined by Daniel Dreisbach. He is a professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University here on Hillsdale's campus to provide a CCA lecture for us on Christianity and the American political tradition. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here.
We appreciate you making some time. You're also the author of the book Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, co-author of a book called Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. We'll sort of spread to all fields among those topics here in our conversation today. I wanted to begin by asking about the American political tradition and its connection to Christianity and the Bible itself. Could the American political system exist without the existence of the Bible?
I think that's an excellent question.
clearly the founding generation was a fairly well-read generation, and they drew on a variety of traditions from the English common law and British constitutionalism. They studied a number of Enlightenment thinkers, people like John Locke and the Baron de Montesquieu. They also drew on Republican traditions, both ancient and modern. That would include the Romans, for example, but as well as more modern thinkers, people like Machiavelli. But I would say that you have to include in that list of influences Christianity and the Bible. This is one of the major traditions that they are both familiar with and that are going to draw on in creating new institutions of government following their independence from Great Britain.
As we look inside the Constitution and our system of government and the idea of having checks and balances on those in power, is that taken from biblical knowledge, the idea that, that man is fallen, that we can't perhaps be trusted with the idea of unrestrained power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's the appropriate place to start this conversation. I think political theorists down through the ages have said you have to have an understanding of human nature before you begin to think about what kinds of institutions of government do we create. And clearly the American founders had a political anthropology that drew on a biblical anthropology. And oftentimes they said so very explicitly. They would look to Genesis chapter 3 and the story of the fall in trying to understand human nature so they could better construct institutions of governance that would take that into account. And the main takeaway from that, of course, is this elaborate system of checks and balances. Amazingly, we find in the Constitution examples of checks within checks within checks, right? So this is an obsession of the founders, and it grows out of their understanding of human nature, an understanding that is clearly informed by Scripture. And again, I think Genesis chapter 3 is their starting point in this idea that man's nature is corrupted by that sin that took place there in the Garden of Eden.
Being explicit about biblical references, I believe you've said that Romans 13 is the most referenced biblical text of the founding era. For those who aren't familiar, fill us in. What does Romans 13 say, and how did it provide some context for the American Revolution and our system of government?
Yes. Now, I think Romans 13 goes to another very difficult question that the founders are asking themselves, and that is, do a people ever have a right to resist or rebel against civil authorities? And they were reading Romans 13, which speaks of the obligation of citizens to be subject to those in authority over them. Now, this is clearly is going to be a challenge for patriotic Americans who are contemplating a separation from Great Britain, for rebelling against King and Parliament. And what they do is they construct, I think, a rather nuanced understanding of Romans 13. I think it's consistent with Romans 13, but it's a rather nuanced reading. And this is not original to the American founders. They're drawing on earlier traditions. Mm-hmm. Most recently, they're drawing on the Reformation and the resistance theology of the Reformation. And the argument goes something like this. God has ordained government and civil magistrates. We are to be in submission to them. But God has created civil authorities to serve the public good. And when civil rulers depart from that obligation to serve the public good, they, in a sense, depose themselves. They become tyrants. They're no longer legitimate civil rulers, and the people are no longer obligated to obey them. In fact, they may even have a duty to resist the civil ruler that departs from serving the public's interest. And this becomes a critical understanding of Scripture that Americans read that sort of gives them a basis for resisting what they believe to be the tyranny of George III in Parliament.
Talking with Daniel Dreisbach, he is on campus here on Hillsdale College's campus to give a lecture, Christianity and the American Political Tradition. What a Just kind of pause for a moment. As we think about our founding fathers, these are 22-year-olds, 24-year-olds. They're younger men. Where do they have this understanding? Where do they get this understanding of the Bible? How are they so wise in the way they approach what they're about to do?
Well, the first thing I would say is clearly the Bible is the most accessible book in late 18th century Americans. If a family owned a Bible, if they owned a book, it was almost certainly the Bible. So it's a book that's found widely in American homes. This is a time before people have shelves filled with books in their homes. So oftentimes there were a limited number of books, but the Bible would always be in that collection of books. But I would also add that the Bible, especially the King James translation of the Bible, which would have been the translation most widely available in America, is an ideal tool for literacy education. It has a language that is simple, but yet capable of communicating complex ideas. And so many in the founding generation, maybe most in the founding generation, learned to read with a copy of the English Bible opened in front of them. And so what we find in the surviving political literature of the founding era is a generation that knew the Bible well. They knew both the famous and the obscure texts because again, it was a fundamental part of their education. And even if some of them depart from the traditional Orthodox understanding of the Bible as God's word, nonetheless, they would have known the Bible and thought of it as a vital toolbox for developing morals and moral education in addition to literacy education. And so that's simply going to be part of the background that this generation is going to bring to various conventions and representative assemblies, and it's going to inform their political thought and constitutional designs.
The founders generally believe God exists and God intervenes in the affairs of men and in the affairs of nations. Is that line of thinking a departure from traditional English political thought?
Well, one of the things I would say, and this is a very general statement, is that there were slightly older traditions on the continent and to a lesser degree, but also true in England, a kind of, we might say, a deist view that rejected the idea of a God who intervenes in the material world. There was also quite common views on the continent that rejected not only Jesus as the Son of God, but really looked at Jesus as sort of a sinister figure, a kind of a fraud, a hoax imposed upon mankind. And what I would suggest, and again, I'm speaking in rather general terms, that is not a view widely held in America in the founding era. Even among those founders who did not accept the Bible as God's word, they almost all viewed Jesus as a wise moral instructor. They saw great value in the moral teachings, perhaps even viewed him as the greatest moral teacher in human history. And so in that sense, I think Americans bring a much more moderate view of perhaps the Enlightenment view of Jesus and Christianity than what you might have found on the European continent at that time and slightly earlier times.
If there is no king and there is no tyrant who is cracking the whip, we will continue in a moment with Daniel Dreisbach from American University, more on Christianity and the American political tradition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, Monte Cristo Classic Number 2. This Figueroa has been described as one of the world's great cigars, a silky Connecticut shade wrapper in combination with the best Dominican tobaccos form this perfectly constructed cigar. The smooth aroma of toasted almonds, vanilla, coffee, and spice round out this classic stick. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
At Stifel Nicolaus, I am committed to offering investors personalized investment guidance. Stifel is a full-service organization with department staff, with professionals that specialize in a wide range of investment opportunities. We strive to give each account, regardless of size, careful individual attention. This is financial advisor Susan Eastman at 530-244-7199. Let's talk today about a personalized plan. Again, that number, 530-244-7199.
Alan Gordon, Coach Master Collision. She had minor damage to her rear bumper. I wrote her an estimate. Later, I received a call. The lady responsible for the damage wanted to pay for the repairs out of pocket. Her insurance agent told her a claim would raise her rates for years. With our experience in the claim process, I explained to her most insurance companies would forgive a claim if the cost was below a minimum amount. I suggested she contact her insurance agent and have them review her policy. She called back very excited. It appeared her policy did extend forgiveness. They would pay for the repairs and she wouldn't be charged with a claim or have to pay a deductible. The accident would not cost her a thing. She was very pleased. Good thing the vehicle owner came to the right place for repairs. We all pay a lot for insurance. Choosing Coachmaster will ensure you get the most for your money. Let this experience work for you. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Daniel Dreisbach, professor of justice, law, and criminology at American University. He is on Hillsdale's campus to deliver a CCA lecture on Christianity and the American political tradition. Dr. Dreisbach, how does a nation promote order and discipline? And do the founders, again, look toward religion to play that role in our lives?
I think that's an interesting question, because I think the American founders, like Republicans throughout history, viewed civic virtue as essential to the success of a system of Republican self-government. John Adams once said, and I think this is a fascinating turn of phrase, he said, "The Bible is the most Republican book ever written." Now, why would he say that? Well, he understands that morality and civic virtue is essential in the people if their experiment in Republicanism is going to work. Because again, the challenge is what replaces external control by the authoritarian ruler's whip and rod. And what Adams is saying, and what Republicans throughout the American nation are saying, is that it's internal moral compass. It's civic virtues and personal discipline that's going to replace the whip and the rod. And Adams is saying there's no better articulation of morality and of that kind of virtue than what we find being taught in the Bible. And it's for that reason that the Bible, he says, is the most Republican book ever written. And by the way, he's not an outlier. This is a rather common sentiment expressed in the American founding era.
Daniel Dreisbach is with us. He is the author of Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers, co-author of Faith and the Founders of the American Republic. He's here on Hillsdale's campus giving a lecture, Christianity and the American Political Tradition. How would you explain how the First and 14th Amendments interact on the issue of the Establishment Clause? Established churches used to be the norm on the state level. How would the founders perhaps have reacted to applying the First Amendment directly to the states?
That's right. Well, this is a very long sort of a process of constitutional history. So if we look at the First Amendment, look at the first few words, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. This is sometimes called the establishment, or more accurately, the non-establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment. And when that was added to the Constitution in 1791, that would have had application to the federal government only. It would be, in essence, saying there shall be no established church of the United States, established church like we found in virtually every European nation at that time and even to the present time, right? The established Church of England. So that was a restriction imposed upon the national government only. And by implication, it left the states free to define their own church-state relationships. And we had established churches at the state level until 1833 in Massachusetts. Now, sometime after that, right after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment is added to the Constitution, and it begins to impose restrictions on the states and, mm-hmm. and state governments. And again, it's going to be another, 75, 80 years after that, that the Supreme Court of the United States begins to interpret that restriction on the states found in the 14th Amendment to include the restriction on establishment of religion found in the First Amendment. And so this is a rather significant expansion of our understanding of what is prohibited by the First Amendment. And so you begin to see courts across the land, beginning in the mid-20th century, begin to disallow certain kinds of religious expressions and exercises at the state level. Again, it's not found exclusively in the First Amendment, but it's the First Amendment as the Supreme Court read it into the 14th Amendment with its prohibitions on the authority of state governments.
You also are the author of the book Thomas Jefferson and the Wall of Separation Between Church and State. And I'll ask about that particular phrase in a moment, but Jefferson has a complicated relationship with religion and churches. How would you describe Jefferson's approach to those subjects?
Well, Jefferson was greatly concerned that established churches were sort of corrupt institutions, could oftentimes become institutions that would restrict and limit the rights and liberties of the people. So he clearly was interested in disallowing the kind of established churches that we had found in colonial America, as well as in most European nations. On the other hand, there were aspects of Jefferson's views that valued what religion had to contribute. Jefferson, for example, said many times that Jesus was the greatest moral teacher there ever was. And so in that sense, he saw the value of what the Bible, what Jesus had to teach in terms of helping to facilitate the civic virtues necessary for Republican government. But he believed, and I think this is a view that ultimately prevails in America, that religion is actually going to have a more vibrant expression when it's disentangled from the state, mm-hmm. When it's disestablished, right? If it's an established church, it's like a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And as Adam Smith taught us, monopolies oftentimes get very fat and lazy. And so one could make the argument, as does Jefferson and Madison and others of that perspective, that if you want to have a vibrant religious culture, the way to achieve that is through disestablishment, not through a monopoly of religion and the state.
That phrase, the wall between church and state, the wall of separation, which people read into the Constitution, but actually is in a letter that Jefferson wrote. Is there a general misunderstanding what Jefferson meant by that phrase?
Well, as you say, I've written a book on this topic, and my basic thesis is this, that the wall that Jefferson erects is not so much a wall between the church and the state. Rather, it's a wall that he erects between the federal government and state governments and religion on the other side of the wall. So in that respect, Jefferson's wall is really an affirmation of the principle of federalism. Federalism being that political system that separates different levels of governance, the federal government from state governments. So I think, yes, I think it's a metaphor that, at least as Jefferson used it, has often been misunderstood, misinterpreted. Again, I think it has less to do with the separation between church and state and more to do with this principle of federalism and the separation of the state government and what the state government is permitted to do and what state governments on the other side of the wall are permitted to do.
I want to end our conversation here by jumping ahead a couple of centuries and making a comparison. As you look around today and see some of the hostility toward religion. And in some cases, the fact that the hostility is rewarded in some way, shape, or form, you're bonused if you're hostile toward religion. Has that always existed across the length of our country? It's something new and different in the past quarter century or so?
I do think that there's something of a different spirit afoot in our own time. There is a louder, more vociferous voice that wants to exclude the expression of faith, the voice of faith from the public marketplace of ideas. But I wouldn't say it's an entirely new development. I think we can look across the broad sweep, not only of American history, but of human history, and find that there have been elements of forces very much antagonistic to the expression of faith, and have desired to restrict it and limit it, its role in the public marketplace of ideas. But certainly, I think that perspective in contemporary American life is, I think, being empowered and reinforced through a variety of powerful individuals and institutions and the like. And so I think we do in fact see a kind of antagonism towards the community of faith and faith-based ideas that strikes me as more vociferous than perhaps we've seen in earlier times.
Daniel Dreisbach is here on campus giving a lecture, Christianity and the American Political Tradition, part of our CCA here on campus. You can find that lecture at the Freedom Library on Hillsdale's website. He is a professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. Daniel Dreisbach, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to join you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller, director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. Also, Daniel Dreisbach from American University. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Get ready to explore the expansive universe of aviation and cutting-edge space technology in Turtle Bay's newest exhibition, Mission Aerospace, presented by Dr. Eric and Tiffany Blassingame and produced by Minotaur Mazes, on display at Turtle Bay Museum January 18th through April 20th. This highly interactive maze puzzle is sure to inspire all generations. Mission Aerospace at Turtle Bay Museum is free for members and included with paid admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Happy New Year, Redding, from your friends at Black Bear Diner, reminding you that if you're looking for more food, more fun, and more family, this is the place to be. You can count on a warm atmosphere and deliciously fresh home-style food. It's the perfect spot for every generation, with something for everyone. Come for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Black Bear Diner, 2605 Hilltop Drive, Redding.
Black Bear Diner.
The National Wild Turkey Federation 26th Annual Redding Chapter Hunting Heritage Banquet is Saturday, March 1st at the Senior Citizen Center at 2290 Benton Drive in Redding. Doors open at 4:30 p.m. and dinner will be served at 6:30. Tickets and sponsorship tables are available by calling 530-526-8350 or get your tickets online at nwtf.org/events.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.